Accession number 8234, rule number 4.
Colonel Draffen, rule 4. You were telling me about the size of the Italian force.
They called it a battalion, but I don't think it was more than about 3 companies of our strength. But they were well dug in, and they got good, well-sighted positions. But the Italians hadn't much heart, really. We thought they had in those days, but when you, after you fought against the Japanese, you realised that they weren't really trying.
Did you suffer many casualties during the fighting?
Yes, I forget how many there were. All I do remember is that there weren't any. There were no Europeans killed. I think there were 1 or 2 Africans killed. They were reasonably heavy. I forget exactly the numbers. Our first European casualty was a Sergeant Jarrett about 2 days later, who was wounded in a skirmish and then died that night.
And were the casualties concentrated in this company that made the direct attack?
Oh, entirely. Yes, entirely.
And what about the Italians? Did you notice if they had had heavy casualties before they gave up?
No. In actual fact, I was adjutant at the time and I didn't get across the river very early. The CO went off and left me behind organising the rear parties, and I didn't get over until everything was, it was dark.
What about prisoners of war? Did you take a...
Quite a number of prisoners of war, but they were sent off to brigade and they were no responsibility of the battalion, so we...
So you didn't see
didn't
them?
Didn't, no.
What sort of rear parties were you having to organise then while the fighting was going on?
Well, no, it was after the fighting was over to get the 2 remaining companies across the river and headquarter company, which was all the transport. And see, we had 80, I think it was 82 lorries for transporting troops alone. And then there were all the company, the battalion lorries, which I think were 30-something for our mess lorries now. Keep us happy.
How did you get them across the river then?
Well, we built, this was another organisation, we put sandbags and we, the first lorries, we had great tow ropes and attached them to the back and had about 50 askaris all holding the rope to let the lorry down this very steep slope to the bottom. But then we realised that it wasn't, the lorry could in actual fact go down under its own steam. Though one turned over on its side, but it was just a question of being extremely careful in the in driving, and I no reflection on the African drivers, but the Europeans took over.
So what happened then after this crossing of the?
The Irish Gorge. Well, we then just pushed on and on, and we went through places like Jigjiga and Harar until we got to Addis. And here, during this period, we were virtually playing box and cox with other battalions. We were leading one day and somebody else would be leading the next. But as I say, it was an administrative rush. And we got ahead of the South Africans, who were supposed to go into Addis first, but they ran out of petrol. And we got ahead of them, and it was Fluffy Folks's brigade which really had the edge on everybody administratively.
Why was that? Was it due to his...
Well, he'd fought in the First World War, and this was one of his strong points. He said, an army marches on its belly, and you must feed them, and you must feed your transport. And he saw to it that we were. And he was absolutely tremendous, and it really got us through. When we, really, there's very little of interest until we were just short of Addis, and there's a road that goes down south to the lakes, to a place called Shashamana, and all this big lake area. And we left two companies there, and the remaining two companies and a skeleton brigade headquarters rushed on to Addis. This was the first time that we'd even got short of petrol, and we estimated that we would get to Addis with about 50 miles of petrol in our tanks, and that's all. But we made it, and we got there the night before, and the reception committee came out and told us, would we wait, and would we go in? And we said, no, we wouldn't. So they said, well, what are you going to do? So we said, well, we will come in tomorrow morning. So everything was arranged with the mayor and corporation, all the nonsense that goes on. And we went in first thing the following morning. Now, it was very interesting because my battalion, unless it's two companies, we established battalion headquarters on the aerodrome. And the Italians were told to bring in their arms and ammunition. And I established an office in one of the Air Force buildings. And after about a couple of hours, an enormous Italian came into my office, saluted very smartly, and said, are you the adjutant? And I said, yes. He said, may I see the commanding officer in beautiful English? I said, no, he's away, but can I help? He said, well, I have just handed over to your B company my forts, and I have come to the conclusion that you haven't got enough troops to man the forts round Addis Ababa. And I said, well, how many forts are there? He said, there are 119. Each with fixed-line machine guns firing along passages between the barbed wire. And he said, every night, the Habash, the local Italian Habash, Abyssinians, come and attack us. And if we don't hold these forts, they'll loot the town and it'll be absolutely frightful. We'll all get murdered, he said. And so I did some quick thinking, and I said, well, I think you better go back and take over these forts. Can you man them for us? He said, yes, of course I can. So I said, well, can you instruct everybody to take over, and I will instruct all my troops to withdraw? He said, yes. So off he went, and he manned these forts, and they manned them for the 2 days that we were there, because we couldn't man 119 forts with two machine guns in each. And they kept the Habash, and there was a battle every night.
Was this the first you'd heard of the Ethiopians' predatory habits?
No. We had one other little incident. No, I'm sorry. We'd seen a little bit, but nothing like that. It wasn't until we were going down into the lakes, just after Addis, that they were enormous forces. I mean, one chap, Colonel Henfrey, who was a farmer from Kenya, he had an affinity with the Habash, and he had 5,000 of these chaps under him, all mounted on little Somali ponies, with one rifle and bandoliers of ammunition round them. You couldn't see them for the ammunition. And this is all they did, and they used to go roaring round the countryside, shooting up everybody and everything they could see. And they were a bit of a menace. In fact, so much so that they attacked us once. They attacked one of the brigade units. So our brigade commander, Colonel Folks, laid on a demonstration, and he got them into a valley, and he got some mortars and some carriers and some machine guns, and he gave a live demonstration in front of them, and he said, now, if you don't behave yourself, that's what I'll do to you. Anyway, we entered Addis with the brigadier and 2 days later, the South Africans, who for political reasons had to be first into Addis, entered with their bands and their all the razzmatazz that they had, plus, of course, the press and the journalists and photographers. And you'll see in the official entry into Addis the South African troops marching in. In actual fact, we'd been there for a day and a half.
It sounds as though you weren't really seriously opposed on the way to Addis.
No, there were these. The Awash Gorge was the most difficult, and after that, it was merely a question of a small dug-in position which had to be pushed out. And various battalions had a little trouble, but there was no real opposition.
You mentioned your sergeant, though, being killed in a skirmish.
How yes, that was one of those skirmishes. Mm. Just after the Awash Gorge, he went off with his patrol and they were trying to get round this position and he got hit.
What were the Italian positions like, these dug-in positions? Were they well constructed?
No. I don't think they were, really. They didn't dig deep enough trenches. And they were fairly easy to spot. When our patrols went out, they didn't have an awful lot of trouble spotting them. They could have been better.
What about wire and mines? Did they use those at all?
At that time, no. There were a few mines in the Awash Gorge, but very little wire. They didn't seem to have bothered about that.
And how was it that you went into Addis Ababa? Do you know who conducted the negotiations with the Italian authorities there?
The Brigadier, because division was back here in Somaliland somewhere. And I don't think they realised how quickly we'd got on. And, of course, the Brigadier wasn't waiting. Once he saw that the South Africans couldn't move because they'd run out of petrol, he just went through them, quite rightly.
So there was no opposition when you actually entered the town?
Oh, no. No, it was declared a free, an open city weeks beforehand.
Were there any incidents of disorder within the town?
No, the askaris were particularly good, actually. I think that we hadn't... This is the first time we'd had the opportunity of getting any loot, and as we left Addis, one noticed the odd mattress on the top of a lorry, this sort of thing, and we soon... the first halt, orders were given that all loot was to be dumped at the side of the road, so that's rather stopped that one. You can't avoid the odd watch and this sort of thing, but all sorts of things came out, as I say, mattresses and refrigerators and one or two little things like that. But we soon disposed of those, and I think the chaps learnt their lesson.
I was thinking more in terms of disorders within the town involving the native population, not involving the askari.
That was terribly easy. They had a mayor and corporation, and the mayor, we told the civilians that they'd got to see that their organisation was kept going, and water supplies and electricity and the rest of it, and they did. They were very good.
So you could leave things to the civil authority?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you walked around Addis in the evening and it was lit up, the street lights were on, and it was perfectly normal.
How long did you actually stay in the town?
Only a day and a half. And then we moved back along the road towards Harar and then down towards this place called Shashamana.
This was the beginning of the Lakes campaign?
The beginning of the Lake battle. And it was there, a place called Fiki, was our next battle, which was, I think, a bigger battle than the Awash Gorge, much bigger. They had a battalion on a hill, well dug in, and it was supposed to be defending a line of communication. And we were ordered to attack it and take it. And we... were told this in the morning, and they said they wanted it captured by the evening. Well, we set off just after lunch, and we had to cross a piece of open ground which was rather swampy. So we had hoped to have some surprise, but unfortunately this ground was so open that an outpost spotted us and they began shelling us. Well, no sooner had the shells started to land than we got a signal from brigade headquarters to say that there was an armoured column expected to come from the west, and would we go back to our previous night area and put a roadblock across and get patrols out against this armoured column. So we withdrew from Fiki without even having fired a shot. They'd fired a few guns at us, and we waited all night on the alert, but nothing happened. This armoured column didn't materialise. So at about 3 or 4 in the morning, we got another signal from the brigadier saying, you can resume the attack at dawn. So we realised by this time that we hadn't a hope of having any surprise. So we got in our lorries and we went to as far as this marshy section where the guns had opened up on us, and we debussed just short of this, which was out of range of the guns, and then off we went. And we sent C Company round on a right hook, and they were very good, very quick and very successful, though it was very difficult terrain, and we had to withhold the attack for about half an hour, if I remember rightly, the main attack, so as to let them get round. And that was one of the occasions when the wireless was working properly. And we then came over a hill. There was quite a skyline which the Italians had covered with mortars and machine guns, and we got our troops down on the farthest down the slope and into the bush where they couldn't be seen, and it was there that I was wounded, so I didn't take any more part.
So this was during the advance to assault position that you were wounded?
Yes. In actual fact, we'd just gone over this ridge, and we had a company in front of us, and they were completely hidden and all reassembling to go to attack further. And we got the mortar platoon up behind the ridge, and the mortar platoon officer was with us directing fire. He was over the ridge where he could see all the enemy positions. And it was rather interesting because I was lying down looking through my binoculars about 20 or 30 yards down from the crest of the hill with my commanding officer on my left and my intelligence officer, John Hard, on my right. And this burst of machine gun came straight over Roger Hurt, the CO's back, and hit me. Didn't touch him, didn't touch my brother-in-law.
So you were hit by a burst from the left flank?
From the left flank, yes.
Not from ahead?
No.
So presumably there must have been an outpost there, which
yes.
Had been missed on the way in.
Yes.
What shape was this hill, roughly speaking?
Well, the hill we were attacking was really a ridge, which was higher than the hill we'd come over, and dominating it completely. And this was the end of the ridge. The machine gun fire came from the end of the ridge, where there was an outpost which nobody had seen.
Had you done a thorough recce of the enemy positions before going in?
No, because, you see, we were sent in the day before, and we were told in the morning that we were to attack this place. Well, it was about 12 miles from where we were halted at that time. And we just had to look at our maps and send forward troops to patrols to see, bring back as much information, but we virtually attacked it blind, so except that we knew exactly where they were, but we didn't know their detail.
So the plan was made on the map then?
Oh yes, the plan was made on the map as far as we could.
And you say the terrain was difficult. How was it difficult?
Well, it was difficult in that there was a lot of low bush. It was rather like our semi-desert country. And there was a lot of low bush, and your visibility, once you got down in the valley, was very poor. Whereas up on the hill, you could look and see everybody down below you.
Was it rocky as well as being?
Yes, it was rocky.
Scrubby.
Very little grass, rocky outcrops. And
did you have any supporting arms there with you, any artillery or anything like
no.
that?
No, the only people we had were our own mortars.
So it's basically purely infantry.
And they were very successful. Very successful. They were firing well that day. They had three or four direct hits.
Could you actually see the Italian positions?
You could see the Italian positions, and you could see the bursts of our mortar shells going over. It was tremendous.
What sort of positions did they have on the top of the hill then?
They're again dug in on the forward slope.
There's trenches.
Yes, trenches and sangars, what they called sangars, made of large piles of this stone, volcanic stone mostly. It was a bit soft, but it all helped.
Did they have, you were saying they had artillery. What sort of artillery?
We thought it must be about a 25-pounder. But I think it was probably a bit less than that, but it was quite useless because they fired these shells and they came whistling over and they dropped quite close to you, but they just went into the bog, you see, and then went poof, and a lot of water came up, nothing else.
So the bog just cushioned the blast?
Just cushioned the blast and everything.
So you had been going forward. How far from the main Italian positions do you think you'd got to?
I should think we were within 100 yards, 150 yards of them.
So that's roughly about bayonet charge distance?
Just about, yes. Yeah.
What happened to you then when you'd been shot?
Well, I was terribly lucky. The RAP was the other side of the hill in the nice safe area, and somebody helped me along, and away I went to the RAP where the doctor was, and he gave me a shot of morphia, so I never had any pain at that period at all.
You say somebody helped you. You weren't put on a stretcher then?
No. My brother-in-law, John Hard, was by me, and he just helped me along. And then it was only about 50 yards, 20 yards up to the top of the hill, and 50, another 30 over to the RAP. And the doctor looked after me after that.
What sort of treatment did you get immediately, apart from your shot of morphia?
Well, the doc bound me up with my first field dressing and gave me a shot of morphia. And there I lay on a stretcher. And I lay there until the evening when the battle was over. And we'd actually taken the position by about 5 o'clock in the evening. Well, then they got up a couple of ambulances, and all the wounded were piled into these ambulances and sent back to the place where we'd had a camp the night before. So I arrived back there. That was the only time that I had any discomfort, because jogging along over the bush in an ambulance, because the morphia wore off, and I wasn't very happy then. Got back at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the doctor had arranged. He was a little man called Dr. Kistner, a South African who had just qualified. This was his first job. And he had a friend who'd also with him at university studying medicine, who'd gone to the 6th Battalion, who were not far away. He got his friend over, and these two doctors put me on a trestle table, gave me an anaesthetic and operated on me with a Dietz lamp.
And the operation presumably was a success.
Yes. I woke up on the stretcher underneath the trestle table. They decided that I was so ill that they couldn't move me, so they got a little Italian tent. I don't know where it came from, but there was an Italian tent which just took me. And I, by this time, somebody produced my camp bed, which we all had. And they left me with my orderly and my personal servant and a platoon to look after me. And away they went, and I stayed there for 10 days. Then an ambulance from division came along and picked me up and took me to Addis. Addis was a wonderful hospital. There was an old Norwegian sister who ran the place. She couldn't speak English, but she was absolutely magnificent. She was the only European, apart from military personnel, in the hospital. She ran it absolutely wonderfully. But my criticism here was, I got very hot under the collar. When we started, when I first went there, there was a South African pilot who had tried to take off a Fiat fighter from the aerodrome and it crashed, and he was in a very bad way. There was another South African who'd had a heart attack, and he was so weak that he had another heart attack lying in bed. And there was a third with jaundice of the worst type, and they were feared for his life. And at the beginning, when I first went there, planes were coming up from Nairobi to Addis Ababa. And there was also, every now and then, a South African plane flying back from the Middle East to Johannesburg. And all these aeroplanes, when they landed, said, can we take any wounded or anything we want? And they evacuated quite a lot of the wounded. This was going extremely well until, I think it was a divisional headquarters medico, decided that this wasn't in the little red book and that we'd all got to wait for a hospital ship to come to Berbera or Djibouti, to Djibouti. And this was going to be months away. So when I got well enough, I had a friend in division who used to come and see me, and I persuaded him to take me down to Addis Hospital, to the headquarters, so that I could meet this brigadier and tell him what I thought of him. And he arranged all this, but when I got down there, the brigadier wasn't available to my mere rank. But the South Africans were tremendous. One morning, after this had started, a South African colonel walked in with a stretcher bearer and just took the young pilot who was so